listening to the Caffeinated Thoughts Podcast. Hi, this is Shane Vanderhart. Welcome back to another episode. We on the Caffeinated Thoughts Podcast are continuing our look at different Iowa House and Senate candidates. This week, at least today, wanted to take a look at Sarah Abdush. She's a Republican candidate in Iowa House District 15. But before we get to my conversation with Sarah, first a word from our sponsors.
Hi, this is Brian Myers. When I needed a better life insurance plan, I found it with Travis Riswold of Modern Woodmen of America. When I first met Travis, he wasn't like some other life insurance agents that can be pushy and try to get you to buy something. Travis just made himself available to me. That was it. He told me to let him know if and when I needed anything, and he stayed in touch. When the day came and I did need to make some changes with my life insurance, Travis met with me and walked me through several options so I could make an informed decision. Ultimately, it was the best decision for my situation. So if you need a life insurance plan that makes sense for you, call my friend Travis Riswold with Modern Woodmen. His number is 515-883-0029. That's Travis Riswold with Modern Woodmen. He can help you find the life insurance you need. Call him at 515-883-0029.
At American Principles Project, we believe that human dignity should be at the heart of public policy. We work in all 50 states and in Washington, D.C. to promote life, religious freedom, local control over education, authentic economic progress for working Americans, and a return to constitutional principles such as federalism. Want to help American Principles Project? Visit our website today, AmericanPrinciplesProject.org. That's AmericanPrinciples, P-L-E-S, project.org. Sign up for email updates. Help us out. We want to work with you. That's AmericanPrinciplesProject.org.
And I'm back. Without further ado, here's my conversation with Sarah Abdush, Republican candidate in Iowa House District 15. Hey, Sarah, thank you so much for taking time to talk with us today. The first question I want to ask you is a question I ask anybody who's running for office, whether they're running for president or whether they're running for county supervisor or dog catcher or whatnot, is why in the world do you want to run?
Yeah, and I think that's a great question because I think you have to be a little bit insane to jump into politics feet first, but I've been involved. I've been an activist for a while in the Republican Party, and honestly, looking at my district and the people here, I think I can represent it very well, and I would be excited to do so. And so, taking that into consideration, I was like, you know, I think I'll try this.
Okay, so what do you think sets you apart from? Because you're running in a contested primary, so. Mm-hmm. Why should voters of your district, Republican voters of your district, choose you over the other guy?
Well, it's actually something. I've been in politics, like I said, for probably about 5 years now. I've been an activist, and before that, I was involved in kind of a tertiary way. I did some door knocking with my mom and stuff like that. I've always been a conservative Republican, though. And because I've been involved for a long time, you kind of see people come and go a lot. And one of the reasons why people come and go is because they tend to get either burnt out of politics or they kind of get wrapped up in this mystique of politics, the prestige and the everyone knows you and all that kind of comes along with having an office. I have already kind of had those temptations laid out before me. And I know that I'm going to stick with my conservative principles. And that, I think, is the biggest thing that sets me apart is because I have faced it already and I'm not going to waver. So you see a lot of people making a lot of promises around election time. I'm not going to make promises that I can't keep.
Okay. So I just wanted to jump right in with some policy stuff here. Mm-hmm. The legislature just passed and Governor Reynolds just signed a fetal heartbeat abortion ban. Is that something you would have been able to support if you were in the legislature at the time?
Yes, I would have supported that. I think there's been a lot of discussion with regards to the exceptions that were in that bill, having to do with rape and incest and all these kind of things that the left trots out whenever they're talking about maintaining abortion as, you know, an uncontested, you know, on demand without restriction anytime, is, I think, their motto right now. And so they always trot out these very, very small percentages that say, you know, we need to have these sorts of exceptions out there. But the fact is, the baby growing in the womb is a life, and it's a separate life. Science says that it is a different human being than either the mother or the father. And the fact that we're taking an action to destroy it, I think, is, it's morally wrong, I think, in my view. So I would have probably said I don't want to vote for the exceptions. I would have voted for it with exceptions because I do think it's a good step forward. But in all honesty, I think abortion is a scourge that needs to be ended.
Okay, so should the the courts, state courts, not shoot down this particular law, how can the pro-life movement, I guess, how can this law be strengthened at the state level should it remain in place? You know, if you were elected, what would you advocate for?
Well, honestly, I do think eventually getting rid of those exceptions would be a good thing. Even if the baby is conceived under circumstances that are really awful, it didn't do anything wrong. And we should not, as a society, I think, be adding one wrong upon another wrong by killing the life that has formed. So I think we should get rid of those exceptions. As far as the heartbeat bill itself, I tend to favor more of a life at conception view. But I do think that saying, hey, once we have a detectable heartbeat, we know there's a nervous system and we're going to be doing a lot of harm to this. I think that that is a fair line to draw at this point, and we can kind of talk about how we move forward as far as abortion in general.
Yeah, I had a talk recently with a person who did not favor, because they have a, you know, huge issues with incrementalism, did not favor a late-term abortion ban, but admitted to me the other day that I don't think we would have gotten heartbeat, you know, ban had they not passed the late-term abortion ban the year before. And
yes,
it's like, and that's the, yeah, that's the thing. You just keep pushing it, you know, keep pushing us further and further as you go. I like thinking of it in terms of a football game. You know, you make first down, you can, you know, I think maybe late term abortion ban was maybe a field goal and this was a touchdown. Game's still not over yet. That's the thing I try to encourage people who maybe have they hate the idea of incrementalism, is that I'm with you if you're talking about the people who, I'm okay, let's pass late term abortion ban but no further, or this ban but no further, but they're not actually trying to end abortion.
Yeah, and honestly, I think that the way I kind of view it, I say, okay, how many lives can we save by passing a late term abortion ban? It's better than none. And obviously, I think all of us would prefer that no babies were being killed in our country.
Absolutely.
But if, you know, the Supreme Court a long time ago decided to write it as, you know, a right into the Constitution, and we're, you know, we have to do everything that we can to push it back, and whatever steps we can take, I think, are worth taking just because of those lives that we will save.
Okay. Shifting gears here to education policy. Obviously, education is one of the, you know, biggest areas that the state legislature has to deal with, because it takes up the most money in the general fund, 57%, when you consider K-12 funding and community college funding, as well as regent universities. What does local control of education look like to you? And how could that be advanced from the state legislature?
That's actually a very good question.
Thank you. I try to ask those every once in a while.
Well, it's a really good one, because it has several layers to unpack. I think one of the first ones is talking about the federal control that has happened and then what the state has done. And then all of these things kind of pile upon what happens in the local school district. So obviously the state adopted Iowa Core, which is sort of the version of the Common Core standards that the federal government pushed out a long time ago.
I think
they adopted that. And,
I said, I think I've heard of those.
Yeah. Yeah, they're fantastic, doing very well for our children. They're so educated. So we kind of have seen this trickle-down effect where the more the Department of Education gets involved, the less control our local teachers have. And what it's been doing, and this is something I don't think anybody would contest, no matter what side of the spectrum they're on as far as politics, the fact is that all of these changes have simply served to increase the administration and reduce the ability of teachers to teach in the classroom. So teachers now have less ability to control what they teach and how they teach it than they ever have. And we have more and more administration than we ever have. And all that money is being poured into these people who are filing the papers and doing all this stuff to send back to the federal government and to the state. I think true local control is when the people who are in the actual school district, the parents, get to make decisions about the curriculum. They get to make decisions about how the money is being spent. And both the parents and the teachers are working together to decide how things should occur. But there's also a very, very clear example of local control is homeschooling. Mm-hmm. Homeschooling, for some reason, has been denigrated. It's unfathomable why, because it's literally the smallest class size you can get and the most personalized teaching you can get. I was homeschooled for my entire life until I went to college.
Yeah,
and I graduated 2 years early because of that. So that's about as local control as you can get. So we obviously need to protect homeschooling and encourage it. But I favor school choice. I think that's another way to bring local control, because then the parents are actually saying, hey, I get to send my kid where I think is best. And there's, you know, a check attached to this child. I can send them wherever I want. And that money that I'm paying right now in my taxes, it goes with them to wherever I choose to send them. So if I want to send them to a nice private school in my area, I can do that. That's local control.
Okay, so you would support education savings accounts?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. The Iowa legislature also passed tax reform that comes. It has a slight reduction in the personal income tax initially, with larger reforms taking place if we meet the revenue trigger that's set. I can't remember what it is off the top of my head. I think we have to reach like $8.1 billion in revenue by like 2022, something like that. It represents basically 4% of a revenue increase each year, each fiscal year, until they hit fiscal year 2022. And then those larger cuts will take place, as well as dropping the nine brackets, personal income tax brackets we have goes from 9 to 4. Now, corporate income tax has a stronger drop, I guess, initially, from the top rate being from 12 point something percent down to, I think, 9.1, 9.2, something like that. Does that go far enough? What would tax reform and tax relief look like? Well, you know, I guess the ideal tax reform, tax relief package, what would that look like for you?
Yeah, and that's actually another really good one, because, again, I think a lot of these issues, when most people think about taxation, they think about their federal taxes, and that's something obviously I wouldn't have much say in the state legislature.
Right.
But once you pile the federal taxes upon the state taxes upon the local taxes, what we see is that every dollar that you're making is being taxed over and over and over again. Every time it changes hands, it's being taxed in some way, shape, or form. And the fact that you had to go through this plan, which it is better than what we had to do.
Right,
it
right.
is better than what we had, but you had to go through it in such a meticulous fashion. I can't do my own taxes. You know, it's one of those things. It's so difficult. We have to buy software. We have to pay accountants to do all this for us because we cannot figure out what the ins and outs of these things are. That's why we need these simple, flatter taxes across the board. Honestly, whenever money is going to be kept in the citizens' pockets and it's not going to be going to government in general, that's what I favor, because I think that each and every one of us can make better decisions for our money than the government can. I know that there are government functions that need to be funded. Things like the roads. I mean, even the schools, yes, they do have to be funded somehow. But they do not need as much as they have been taking. And what tends to happen is, because this money is available, it's being given out in grants and all of that, there's an incentive out there to spend all of it so they can make the case next year that they need more. So I was very pleased that we went through the tax reform process and that the rates were lowered. I do think it's reasonable to have a trigger in there that says, hey, we'll continue to lower it if, you know, if it's not being detrimental to the budget that we need. But at the same time, we need to be taking very serious looks at what can be cut and what should be cut, because if we require such a high amount of money, sometimes, you know, you have to take a look at it and say, maybe I'm doing things that I don't need to be doing.
It's right.
Just kind of simple budgeting.
So, you know, I've always said that Iowa has a spending problem, not a revenue problem. Would you agree with that?
Yes. And that's kind of the same problem in the federal government.
Yeah.
It's one of those things. Because each of us, I'm sure, have done our own budgets. I've gone through Dave Ramsey's program, and I'm in the process of paying off student loans and kind of, you know, starting to build wealth as an adult, right?
Right.
And one of the first things you have to do is you have to look at what you're spending, and you have to cut out those things that are not necessary. So you start with the things that are necessary, you pay for those first, and then you start paying on your debt. You get your debt taken care of. You don't handle all this extra stuff. You don't handle grants to colleges so that they can do these studies and all of that. I know that sometimes we get really good information out of that, but we are so far in debt. We're spending our kids' money already that they are not even born to make yet. And that's immoral. So yeah, we need to get our fiscal house in order. I think that remains true.
So
tax cuts are very good, but
so what do you think would be some positive steps for the state government to do that, get their fiscal house in order, as we see the budget keeps, you know, increasing year after year? And I think that's going to happen anyway. I mean, to some extent, it's uncontrollable because of, you know, as our population grows and as our school enrollment grows, we're going to see some of that increase just because we have more people. But, you know, there are things, there are ways to approach spending that could probably be done in a more fiscal responsible manner.
Yeah. And actually, I'm going to say a couple things here that are going to be fairly unpopular opinions, but I think that they're good places to start. So one of the first things that we need to do is look at the laws that govern things. Let's take the schools, for example, because that is the largest budget item right now.
Mm-hmm.
What are those rules that are adding to the administrative overhead? Why can't we trust, you know, this person or that person to do this instead of, you know, having to have a second person to look over their shoulder and make sure they're doing it, send in the paperwork and do all this stuff. That's one of the first things that we need to look at, is sort of the overcomplication of our system of laws. As you build laws upon each other, or these regulations increase, people don't know what they're supposed to do. So then they have to hire other people to do those things, and that increases costs across the board, especially in education. But another thing that we need to look at is, who are we paying for with our system? Because entitlements and sort of the social safety net stuff and education and all of that, again, these are a huge chunk of the budget. And the fact is, we know this, There are a lot of people here in the country who are here illegally, who are not paying into the system, or at least if they are, they haven't been paying in for very long, and they're pulling the same benefits as American citizens and legal immigrants with green cards. And that's not okay. And obviously, again, as a state legislator, we only have so much control over it. But this does come down to, you know, you do have relationships, you do have responsibilities. So I would definitely be in touch with our federal representatives and making sure that they know we need to get things like the border closed, that we can actually control who is coming here. So much of our local problems are played into by the problems at the federal level, the lack of law and governance that is happening there. It trickles down, and then we at the state level have to deal with it. And that's a really, really big problem. So if we have an open border, we have people coming in, you know, using our schools, using our emergency rooms, not paying for any of it, obviously it's going to be a much more expensive system. So.
We
I said it would be very unpopular.
No, well, you know, no, I think you're spot on. But yeah, I definitely from the progressive point of view, you know, there's absolute heresy. Looking at property tax reform, one of the big expenditures in our general fund is property tax backfilling because that was something that was agreed to when they passed property tax reform. And that's a huge chunk of money. You have some counties and municipalities that probably need that, but some are others are doing well and have recovered that and are actually flourishing. Is that something you think the state legislature needs to look at in the next couple sessions?
Yeah, and I don't know enough about that. I haven't done any research on that topic specifically, so okay. I would have to do some more research to know for sure. But in general, I think all programs need to be evaluated regularly to make sure that they are still operating as they were supposed to. So if they are no longer needed, we do not need that expenditure any longer.
Okay. Then I also wanted to ask you how one of my biggest disappointments from the 2018 Iowa legislative session was that they did not do anything to pass religious liberty protection. How can the state of Iowa protect religious liberty in the face of increasing, I guess I'm trying to think of the right word for it, encroachment on those liberties by those who are pushing sexual orientation and gender identity laws? Obviously, there are other ways that religious liberty could be hindered as well, but that seems to be the big thing that we're seeing lately. How can the state of Iowa, I guess, balance? You don't want to discriminate, but yet you also want to protect religious liberty as well.
Yeah, and this is going to be, I think, another one where I have a very not popular opinion.
I think that just depends on what crowd you're talking about.
Yeah. Well, I've studied this issue a lot, and the problem is we actually have very, very good religious liberty on the books. That's actually one of our rights. It's a guarantee under both the federal constitution and the Iowa constitution. So in all honesty, we shouldn't need to pass these laws like the Religious Freedom Restoration Act and all that. It should never have had to occur because the constitution guarantees the right to express your religion. Now, one of the biggest problems that has kind of skewed those interpretations is because of the courts. Mm-hmm. And what we see a lot of times is that whenever somebody has a beef with how somebody else is handling their business, let's take that couple, I'm blanking out on their name now, but they had, you know, their barn and their kind of land that they were using for wedding ceremonies and receptions. Mm-hmm. And they were told that they cannot operate it if they are not going to allow people, same-sex couples, to get married there.
Right.
And that came about because of the courts, and the courts wrongly interpreting our religious freedom that is on the books. So honestly, I think more than anything, what we need to look at is how do we control the courts? Because our system of justice was based upon, it's supposed to be blind justice. It's supposed to be something where you don't get to shop around for a judge that's going to hear your case and be favorable to you. But that's what happens, and everybody knows it.
Right.
If you go to one place and they say, no, that's not something I agree with, you can go to a different district and say, hey, will you take this up? And a judge will say, fine, yeah, I'm totally on board with this. And then you already have a skewed legal system.
Right.
So what we need to look at, I think, more than anything, is how do we reform the justice system, and how do we reform how these judges are expected to behave? Because it seems like now they think their opinion is the law rather than the law,
right?
And the plain interpretation of it, and that's very wrong. So we need mechanisms to be able to overturn these sorts of, you know, gross miscarriages of justice in a legal and, you know, safe ways, so that we're not just, you know, saying willy-nilly, well, we're not going to go with that just because we don't agree with it.
Yeah.
But whenever something really egregious does happen, we need a way to overturn it and say, no, you're the one who's misinterpreting this law.
Well, a couple thoughts. Yeah, a couple thoughts. One, I guess at the state level, I'm not entirely sure if there's been a court case dealing with the Iowa Civil Rights Act as applied to religious liberty and religious conscience. Maybe I'm wrong. I just don't recall if that's been the case. I know the Iowa Civil Rights Commission has been involved in complaints, and they obviously have gone lean towards the sexual orientation, gender identity type of agenda away from religious liberty. Now, I totally agree with you that the courts do need to be reformed, because, you know, obviously we've got a bunch of activist judges. And frankly, I think even though the left will say, because of the Missouri plan and in the Iowa Constitution, that we have nonpartisan courts, but honestly, it's politicized. It's just under the radar. Nobody really sees it. It's not transparent. A couple things occur to me. In the state constitution, I've never seen a law passed with this stipulation in it. I've seen bills with it written, the language in it, but I've never seen a bill passed. The Iowa legislature can limit the jurisdiction of, you know, the courts, including the Supreme Court. Is that something that you would you be in favor of, bills with that type of language, and would you sponsor bills with that kind of language, placing a check and a restriction on the Iowa Supreme Court?
Yeah, honestly, it's funny to me because people seem to think that the courts are this lone entity out there. But even at the federal level, the courts, for the most part, except for the federal Supreme Court, those are entities created and controlled by the legislative branch.
Right.
And that's the same in Iowa. So whenever the legislature says, hey, you know, the courts are doing this over here, it's not something that's acceptable, so we're going to reform, we're going to change this to limit their jurisdiction and the way that they behave, people act like that's very, very radical. But that's just their job. They're essentially handling a part of their responsibility whenever they say that. So I would absolutely be in favor of looking at that. Our court system has not changed a whole lot, but the activism certainly has.
Okay.
And that's a very big problem.
And as far as, you know, another thought, I would love to see a constitutional amendment repealing the Missouri plan, in exchange and replace it with, I guess, kind of what we see at the federal level with courts. I don't, you know, I never could quite understand why Iowans, when they first adopted the Missouri plan, why they felt like the federal method of appointing judges and confirming judges wasn't, you know, right for the state. The only thing about judges in the state of Iowa that I like is the retention vote. but I think the whole appointment process is crap because, well, frankly, you know, the governor doesn't really have control over who they can appoint. They're given a choice of three, generally, and they have to pick one. And if they don't, after a certain amount of time, the Chief Justice Supreme Court can pick one. So it just seems like there's a lot in the hands of unelected folks, a lot of control that they have, and there's a lot of power given to the Iowa Bar Association in selecting judges. You know, those are my ideas. How do you think we can reform judicial selection?
Yeah, again, I would have to look into the details of the Missouri plan and all of that to know for sure where I stand on it and what sort of reforms I think are necessary. But in general, again, and this is kind of where it comes down to what your principles are. Mm-hmm. Your core principles are how you make decisions. And one of my core principles is that we've seen legislatures in the state and the federal level offloading their responsibilities onto unelected branches of government, including the courts. And so anytime that happens, it takes away my ability to have a direct say in what happens in our government. And that's a very big problem. It's no wonder people think that whatever is going to happen is going to happen, and it's all out of their hands, and their vote doesn't matter. So in general, if we can bring things back and make it so that these decisions are happening from people who are directly elected, so that they are accountable directly to their constituents whenever they make these decisions, I think that is better for our republic.
Okay. Last question. I'd like to eventually talk to you about Convention of the States, but we're already like at half an hour, and that's probably a whole different podcast. So I'll have to have you back just to talk about that, because you've been a huge proponent of that in the state of Iowa. But I just wanted to open up the question. Where can people learn more about your campaign? And is there anything we didn't talk about, you know, today so far that you want to make sure our listeners are aware of?
So I can be found at abdoucheforiowa.com. Again, it's abdoucheforiowa.com. And you can kind of see where I stand on the issues there, see upcoming events and all of that. But if there were one issue that we haven't discussed yet, and I just kind of want to hit on this very briefly, it would be the issue of drug rehabilitation.
Okay.
And I know that's a pretty lengthy topic, and I won't try and unpack it all right here, right now. But that is something I am very concerned about. Drugs have affected my family pretty severely on one side, at least. And the way that we deal with it now is even more important, because the sort of drugs that are coming up mostly through the southern border into the state are highly addictive. They're causing a lot of problems and tearing up these small communities in Iowa. Council Bluffs has its own problems with that, but our drug rehabilitation programs need to be strengthened. They need to be localized, and they need to be done through non-governmental organizations that can kind of keep track of these people and you know, sort of move them to places where they can get out of this cycle of abuse, and hopefully give them something more important than the drug to help them overcome their addictions. So that's something I really want to focus on while I'm in the legislature, if I make it, because it's becoming a growing crisis, not just opioids, but also a new crisis with methamphetamine abuse. And I just think that we need to turn our attention to that very seriously and deal with it. So that would be something I would focus on.
Great. Well, hey, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it. Good. Best of luck to you. We'll be keeping track of the race. And I'll have to have you back on to talk about Article 5. And anyway, thank you so much. Take care.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
All right. Talk to you later.
All right. Bye.
Bye-bye. And that concludes today's episode of the Caffeinated Thoughts podcast. Thank you so much for listening. If you happen to be listening to this podcast somewhere other than on our website, I just want to encourage you to go to caffeinatedthoughts.com. And that's caffeinatedthoughts.com. Or you more easier still, you could just Google Caffeinated Thoughts and it'll show up at the top of your search screen.
I appreciate you listening. Also, be sure to like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, sign up for our email updates. That way you don't miss a single article. Until next time, my friends, this is Shane Vanderhart. Take care.